Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Samuel Schindler, Associate Professor at the Center for Science Studies at Aarhus University in Denmark. His new book, Theoretical Virtues in Science, Uncovering Reality Through Theory, is just out from Cambridge University Press. A fundamental problem in science and in philosophy of science is that of theory choice. Scientists propose theories to explain data, and it's usually the case that more than one theory can do a job of explaining the same data. That's the basis of many controversies within science. But when two scientific theories can both explain the same data or are equally empirically adequate, what criteria do scientists use to choose between them? What makes one better than the other and gain more adherence within the relevant scientific community, even beyond empirical adequacy? And given that even very popular scientific theories can turn out to be wrong, how are these criteria for theory choice related to truth? Do scientists even aim at true theories, as realists hold, or as anti-realists hold, do they just care about the fact that the theories can explain what's observed, and whether they're true or not is really not the issue? In his new book, Schindler lays out an extended case for the realist position, based on a close critical look at the main virtues that scientific theories are thought to aim for, besides empirical adequacy, such as simplicity, kind of coherence or non-ad hocness, explanatory scope, and fruitfulness, right? Especially in the sense of providing the means to make novel, successful predictions. There are others, but on Schindler's view, all of these extra empirical virtues are what he calls truth conducive or epistemic. That is, they're not just merely pragmatic means that make a theory easier to use. So, for example, a simpler theory is also supposed to be more likely to be true. And so, if that's the case, then scientists are epistemically justified in choosing a simpler theory over an empirically adequate but more complicated rival. So, the book is an excellent discussion of the theoretical virtues themselves, but also their roles in actual theory choices and their role in the anti-realist-realist debate about the nature of scientific theory and scientific commitments. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Samuel Schindler. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie.
Great to have you here and talk about your new book.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the book itself, I'd like to start by giving our listeners a little bit of information about, you know, how you came to philosophy and your interest in philosophy of science, and in particular, how you came to write this book.
All right. So I think my interest actually was in philosophy, in particular history and philosophy of science. Those always kind of went together for me. Was sparked by Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which I read as a 19-year-old, and that really had an effect on me. And then but I was also at the time interested in reading popular neuroscience and philosophical treatments of neuroscientific results. And then I decided to study cognitive science, did a bachelor in that. But then I kind of rediscovered my interest in history and philosophy of science by taking some courses in the philosophy department there. Then I knew this is what I wanted to do. And I also spent a year in Montreal, in Canada, at McGill University, and had the luck to sit in some lectures by Mario Bunge. So several philosophy of science lectures I attended with him, and that just affirmed me in my plan. And then I studied history and philosophy of science as a master's degree in Leeds right after Canada, basically, and then did a PhD with Stephen French, who's known as a structural realist. So that's where my interest in the realism debate comes from. Yeah.
So the book is, I think of it as an extended defense of realism about scientific theories. And that, as you nicely note in the introduction to the book, philosophy of science has in recent years become, somewhat particularized in terms of, people who do philosophy of physics, people who do philosophy of biology, all these different sub areas, but that there is still a need for, and I think this is absolutely true, a need for more general philosophy of science about science as a discipline, scientific theories in general, and the idea of course, how we should understand the relationship between theories and the world, right? And so you firmly sort of put yourself in this more traditional, you might say, camp of addressing a fundamental problem sort of across the sciences, right? So one of the questions that came up that you address kind of at the end of the book, but it might be worthwhile to say a little something about it at the beginning, is just this idea of, how do you distinguish, say, a scientific theory from some sort of proposal that doesn't count as a scientific theory, so before you even get to the question of being a realist about a scientific theory, how do you place yourself in the debate about what is called the demarcation problem of distinguishing a science or a scientific theory, to be more specific, from something that's not scientific?
Yeah, that's interesting that you start with that question. So as I put that in the epilogue, because I think these questions, the two questions, what demarcates science from non-science or pseudoscience, and the question, what is a good or not so good scientific theory? These are slightly independent questions, but I think it's nevertheless an important question, interesting question. I don't pretend to have an answer to the question. I don't pretend to have a solution. But what I do in the book is I try to understand what would be required for a good solution of the problem. And it's been very popular recently to think of the demarcation problem, or of describing the sciences in terms of Wittgenstein's idea of family resemblance. So there's this widespread belief in the philosophy of science community, and it has some plausibility, of course, that the sciences are extremely diverse and different. And there's not really, one thing you can say about them all, let alone provide necessary or sufficient conditions you know, that would delineate the science kind. And I think this is, you know, using the Wittgensteinian concept. So basically, the idea that, you know, the sciences form a family resemblance. So there are similarities between them, but there's nothing that really, you know, that they all share. I think that faces some difficulties, and that concept is often used maybe in a not very reflective way. And there's some important criticisms that have been made of the concepts more generally, which I mentioned in the epilogue. So one is the well-known problem, of course, of wide open texture. So if anything is similar to anything else, as we know from Goodman, at the very least, and we use similarity to individuate the sciences, then it's hard to say, you know, where we should draw the line if similarity is all we can go by. But there's also, I think, a positive problem. So even if you have similarity, that might not be enough, you know, for an individuation. So for example, if you know, let's say I have protruding ears. That's my example in the epilogue. You know, my similarity with Barack Obama having protruding ears, that's not sufficient, right, for us to form a family. So so more is required than that. In this case, of course, it would be hereditary relations that, you know, that justified our use of these similarities in this case. Another problem that's related with using family resemblance as a concept when it comes to the demarcation problem is that what we want is we want some normativity, and if we have such meager grounds for in and exclusion on the family resemblance concept, then that seems pretty hopeless. So we want to say that, for example, we don't want to teach creationism in our schools, for example, because it's not a good science. It's hard to see how we could say that on the family resemblance concept. Okay, now to my, again, it's not really a positive proposal, but it's more an attempt to try to understand, you know, what a good solution would look like, and I suggest the so-called basic predicate solution or the paradigm solution, and that is the idea that, you know, that that there may be one science out there, let's say physics, which has a lot of the which has a lot of the features that we recognize as scientific, and again, that doesn't need to be an actual science. It could be something more abstract. So it's a list of features which we consider to be important for an activity to be scientific. We can say that, you know, that our particular science, let's say biology, if it shares a feature with this basic predicate or this paradigm, then, or, you know, at least one, then that could be enough for that activity to be recognized as a science. But there is something, you know, that we can point to and say, you know, this is the reason why this is a science or it's not. On this solution, you like on the family concept, so that's why it's why it also should have some appeal for people who like family resemblance, is that it need not be the case, you know, that any of the sciences we're looking at have anything in common. As long as they have something in common with that basic predicate, then that would be justification enough for us calling those sciences members of the science kind. Yeah, but again, yeah. So this is something that I don't consider, you know, very central for. You know, for some of the arguments I'm making in the book. So the main focus is, of course, theoretical virtues in science. And now, but given this, you know, this idea of the basic predicate solution, that if you say something true about, say, physics, and you successfully identify the virtue of physical theories, then if physics is a science and that's uncontroversial, right? Then you automatically will have said something about science, about that, you know, that or about, you know, virtues that you know that are important in science.
Right. I mean, I think that was what sort of prompted my question was that obviously, or maybe not so obviously, but it would seem that there's certainly room for you might call it a virtue theoretic argument for what is a science and what isn't. You know, again, maybe it's family resemblance or not, but you know, where, you know, if you want to put it this way, paradigms have these qualities. These theoretical virtues, and you know, if you have these theoretical virtues, that's a good sign that you are a science or something like that. In other words, the virtues play, it seemed to me, play a role, not just in the realism anti-realism debate within the domain of scientific theories, but it also appears to play some sort of a role in the demarcation problem itself. Yeah. So let's get, you know, I want to get to your four, what you call your virtuous arguments. I like that title. So, you know, the core one seems to be the idea that a very virtuous theory, one that exhibits, you know, more of the standard theoretical virtues is more likely to be true, right? And that, of course, is the paradigm realist claim about theories, that they do aim to be true rather than merely empirically adequate. And then you have a series of other sort of sub-arguments, I suppose, or supporting arguments that various theoretical virtues are indeed truth-conducive, you know, or at least have epistemic elements to them. They're not entirely pragmatic. So before we get into each of, or at least a number of those arguments, maybe we should say something about what are the theoretical virtues that we are concerned with? You know, the list is usually things like simplicity or not being ad hoc or being unifying in some way. Could you say a bit about, you know, what the theoretical virtues are and how you define them?
Yeah, sure. So I'm not, you know, extremely creative in drawing up the list. I basically use the list that was drawn up by Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, in his famous article about theory choice. And so he mentions five virtues. I add a couple, I consider those to be not extremely controversial. So there may be other virtues as well, but you could consider those maybe as some kind of minimal set of theoretical virtues. So the first one is, of course, empirical accuracy. So theory's claims about the observable phenomena ought to be true. I talk about empirical accuracy in the first chapter. There's, of course, also empirical adequacy, as defined by Basser and Frasen, which is much more far-reaching. So the truth of a theory about a theory's observable claims of the past, present, and future. Then there's consistency. So consistency for Kuhn discusses that as one virtue, but that can be subdivided, of course, into internal and external consistency. So internal consistency is just the requirement that a theory ought not to say P and not P, or you ought not to be able to derive contradictions from your theory. And then there's also the external consistency would be that a theory ought not to be inconsistent with some of our background theories that presumably have some support, empirical support. It's important to note at this point already that we're not talking about necessary conditions, obviously, that a theory has got to have, but as of virtues. So we're talking about things that would be good for a theory to have, properties of theories. So there are these cases like the Bohr model of the atom, and that's a bit, that's controversial. Some people have claimed that it's that an inconsistency is involved there. There's some discussion about that, whether that's actually the case, but I take it that there are, there are examples where we have inconsistencies, and that's something that scientists are probably not happy about and try to fix. But it's not the case that you won't find any scientific theories that are inconsistent, I think. Particularly when it comes to external consistency, that makes a lot of sense when you propose a new theory, and it can happen that you get an inconsistency with the background knowledge. For example, when quantum mechanics was proposed, that seemed inconsistent with classical mechanics. So that does happen. Not necessarily bad. A third virtue is scope or unifying power. So a theory's capacity to unify the phenomena, and I like to distinguish between, on the one hand, the number of phenomena captured by a theory, so you could call that scope, and unifying power could be something more. It could really be getting at the structure of things. For example, before Newton's theory, people thought the heavenly motions or the planetary motions, there was a different kind of motion from the motion that we have here on Earth, a terrestrial motion. Newton unified these phenomena at a deeper level. So that would be, so that would be an example for unifying power. And of course, you can have scope. You can explain a lot of phenomena without having unifying power, and vice versa. Fruitfulness, usually it's construed in terms of a theory's novel success, or a theory making predictions and us then confirming these predictions or discovering the phenomena that are predicted by the theory. And there are also other senses of fruitfulness that don't play so much a role in the realism debate, but it's actually also part of the book. So another example would be, a fruitful research program, and Lakatosh is associated with that idea, of course, but also Ernie McMullen. But we're probably going to get to talk about that a bit later. Testability, that's, many people's favorite thing, or at least scientists' favorites. So the idea that a theory has to it has to be possible to prove the theory wrong. The theory has to make predictions not only about future events, but also something that we know already, and it needs to be possible to that the theory can turn out wrong on the basis of these observations, and that seems also a prerequisite for the theory receiving empirical support of the phenomena that actually accommodates that it could also turn. Could have turned out wrong on the base if the experimental results had been different than the theory predicted. And lastly, I also add non-ad hocness. So that's something that I think has been neglected a little bit in recent debates, in the realism debate in particular. That played a big role in the 60s up till the 80s, between Popper, Lakatosh, and Kuhn to some extent. Feyerabend can also be mentioned here. So the idea that theory shouldn't explain the phenomenon in ad hoc fashion, or you shouldn't introduce ad hoc hypotheses that save your theory from refutation when there is a mismatch. Yeah, so these are the virtues that I take to be, a minimal set of virtues for a good scientific theory.
Good. So, but as you proceed in the book, the main, I would say, what you call the core or central argument for realism is what you call the no virtue coincidence argument. And you introduce it in the context of what is often called the pessimistic meta-induction, right? Which is, against realism, which is just the idea, in a word, that scientific theories come and go. You know, we've often believed theories that turn out to be false. You know, we thought they were true. They turn out to be false. This is the history of science. It's a big heap of, you know, of theories that we've discarded. And there's no reason to think that the theories that we have now are not going to be subject to the same fate, right? That eventually these theories that realists will say are true, it turns out that we're not. And so the conclusion for the anti-realists is, you know, we should be a bit more epistemically conservative and not claim that our theories are true, and just sort of step back from that to a more conservative claim and just say, well, you know, as long as they're empirically adequate in some way, or then that's good enough. Right. So that's the pessimistic meta-induction, and it plays an enormous role in the realist anti-realist debate. And there's new versions of it that you mentioned there, in terms of the base rate fallacy problem and so forth. Could you say a bit about that issue between the realists and anti-realists, and then your no virtue coincidence argument?
Yeah. The pessimistic meta-induction has played a huge role in the recent realism debate, and that's been shaped very much by the work of Larry Lawden, but also Silos. As you mentioned already, so there are these past theories that allegedly had some success, but nevertheless turned out to be false, and that is taken to be evidence against the realist's no miracles argument, namely the idea that it would be a miracle if our theories and our science were as successful as they are and not be true. So some people could read the pessimistic induction really as an induction about the way we infer the falsities of our current theories, and that's something that I think is not quite right. I think, and then that's a point made by Silos, but also Lyons more recently, maybe, Sarsis, that actually this looks more like a modus tollens, where you say that success is not an indicator of truth. Right, so you try to pull those two properties apart with that induction. It's not so much saying that actually our current theories are false. It's just to say that we don't have grounds to believe that the success of our current theories gives us reason to believe in their truth. Okay, and a lot of the debate has focused now on this so-called divided emperor move, we try to identify elements in past theories that were successful that were carried over to current theories. And if you can do that, then you can show that these true elements that were retained, then you have some continuity that you need for your realism. And you can still hold on to the no miracle argument and the explanation of the success of science. Because already the success of these apparently false theories in the past was explained by the true elements, and there's quite some debate about the particular theories. Has this particular theory in the past turned out false but was successful, does it have true elements? Does it not, or approximately true at least? And people are divided over this, I think the balance is in the realist's favor, as you might have guessed. But anyways, I step back a little bit from this debate and ask, okay, what would actually be shown if we actually could, if somebody would convincingly demonstrate that there is a theory that's false and had success. I think that wouldn't necessarily undermine the no miracles argument. I think that the right way to think of the no miracles argument is as some kind of probabilistic argument that makes it more likely that the theory is true, given that it's successful. Presenting a couple of examples that won't win the argument, I think. But an even stronger, more severe problem that I focus on in this problem is the so-called base rate fallacy. Yeah. So Magnus and Callender, they have pointed out, and that they build on work by Kohnhausen, that the posterior probability, of course, depends on the prior probability of a theory being true, and we don't really have any access to that prior probability, or we can just set that prior probability as we please, and then there's not really any point in arguing about these, about the question of, you know, whether success theory success is a good indicator for its truth, because it can actually even if that were a good indicator, if the base rate of true theories is actually very low, then you have a problem as a realist. So there's this medical example that is often being mentioned. So imagine you have a medical test, and the test has there's a low false positive rate, so it has a very low probability of giving you a positive test result if there's no disease, and it has a high probability of indicating positive result when there's actually disease in the patient. But if the incidence of the disease is very low, if you say have only one sick patient in a population of 1,000 subjects, and if you say have a false positive rate of 5%, then the probability of actually having the disease when tested positive is not, as many people would guess, 95%, but rather very low. It would be about 2%. So in the realism debate, something analogous holds, and Marcus and Port and Callender point out that's problematic because we have no way of accessing these prior probabilities, or we are free to set them as we wish, depending on whether you're Bayesian or a frequentist. But that's secondary. Yeah, so that's a problem, and I try to engage with that problem. So it's a difficult problem, So what I make use of in this chapter is, in the book, is an insight developed by John Ehrman. So, if you have a crime happening, you have witnesses reporting that crime, you have witnesses reporting that crime. These witnesses are independent, and as the number of witnesses increases, if the witnesses are only relatively reliable, so if the false positive rate of those witnesses reporting a crime is lower than the true positive rate, the true positive rate could be lower than 50%, but as long as that condition holds and the number of witnesses goes towards infinity, then your prior probability of the the crime actually occurring could go to zero, and you could still what you still get is that that the crime happened. And of course we don't have as nice a situation like that in science. The number of scientists is limited. There's of course a limit to the pull of this kind of argument when you apply it to the sciences. So the idea is that analogously that the more relatively reliable scientists embrace a theory on the basis of its virtues, the more likely that the theory will be true, regardless how low the prior probability is. But yeah, or so the more scientists embrace them, the lower the prior probability can be. And it can still be the case that the posterior probability is fairly high, above 50%. So that's the rough idea.
No virtue coincidence. Could you?
That's right. That's an important part. I used the Kuhnian framework of theory choice in that argument, and Kuhn assumes that, or Kuhn claims that scientists have different order preferences when it comes to the virtues, right? So some scientists will prefer, for example, simplicity. Some will prefer unifying power. You know, when they judge whether the theory is true or not. And there might be conflicts, there might be theories that have some virtues but not others. That's also something that he says. And I think both of these assumptions are very plausible. But if you have that, then you can still have convergence of the choices of those of scientists and their preference. You can still have convergence of the choices of scientists and a convergence on one theory if you have a theory that has all the virtues, right? So if you prefer simplicity and I prefer unifying power, again, it doesn't mean that these are the only criteria used, but we have this order preference, a theory has all the virtues, then we will end up choosing the same theory, right? Because that theory, in contrast to other theories, will have all the virtues. So that's something, another assumption. So on the Kuhnian framework, it's assumed that you have these conflicts between these virtues, often that some theories have some virtues but not but others. Yeah, some theories have some virtues and others have other virtues, but you often don't get these convergences of virtues in one theory. But if my point is that if you do, then that gives you good reasons to think that the theory is correct, because then it's likely that relatively reliable scientists will converge in their choices on this theory.
Okay, so let me just this is very a very simplistic way of putting it, and so the reason why I'll say it is so that you can push back and tell me where what you say differs. But it sounds like, to some extent, it's an argument that the greater the consensus of scientists around a theory, the more likely it is to be true. So, global warming is a perfect example nowadays, right? I mean, there's all this fight about 95% or 97% of scientists doing climate science, converge. They may not have the same model, but they all agree on the basis of different sources of evidence, that it's happening, right? And so this is, this is a huge actual argument that is used for arguing that, there's this great consensus about global warming. We should believe that, global warming is actually happening. So how would you say that your no virtue coincidence, argument sort of differs from a, very crude thing that just says, well, if there's more consensus about a theory, then that's more likely to be true.
Mm-hmm. No, that's an interesting example. Yeah, I like that. And of course, in the example, the subjects we're talking about must be reliable, right? So it's not enough for some climate deniers to climate change deniers to converge on the idea that there is no climate change. I mean, that wouldn't be enough. In that sense, it's similar, but. I mean, obviously, it's implicit in the realism debate, right? That the theories that we have, or the theories that we that the theories that sorry that the realist wants to be realist about are current best theories that they are embraced by the majority of the scientific community, but it hasn't played, you know, a very prominent role, that kind of convergence in the realism debate, and it hasn't been recognized that could, you know, could be a solution to the space problem. Of course, not, you know, not a complete solution, but or, you know, it's not a knockdown argument, but it certainly prompts realists and anti-realists to you know, to think hard about these you know, what you can call error rates. So what, you know, what would be the what would be reasonable error rates for scientists in judging these virtues, rather than worrying too much about the priors. Yeah, so that's the upshot of my chapter, that we can actually have a, you know, rational debate after all about these error rates.
I see. Okay, yeah, so good. So let's see, let's go to novel predictive success. I mean, again, that's that particular virtue that, you know, I have a theory, or, you know, theory A is able to make this, you know, surprising prediction. I mean, we like surprising predictions, but that's not essential to the idea that you make some prediction about some new phenomenon and it turns out to be, it turns out to come out as you expect, right? I won't say comes out true, it's just successful in some way. And that has been a very important player in this debate as well. The idea that a better theory, and for a realist, a truer theory, is one that will make these novel predictions, and they will come out true. Can you have an interesting take on this? I mean, you don't think that realists should rely on this feature of novel predictive success to support their view. So could you say something about that?
Absolutely, yeah. So there are various versions of novel success. And the most straightforward version is, of course, you know, the temporal version, where, as you already said, that you know, a theory makes a prediction, and later on we discovered, or we discovered a phenomenon predicted by the theory, and that has been criticized quite effectively, I think, and many people appreciate that, by John Worrell in particular, but also others, and he has two criticisms. So one criticism is that there seems to be no rationale for why the mere time order of, you know, proposing a theory and, you know, gathering the relevant evidence, why the mere time order should matter to us, believing that we get more confirmation from a successful prediction than from an accommodation. And the other point he makes is that's motivated by historical examples. So the probably most famous one is his discussion of the prediction by Fresnel's wave theory of light of the so-called bright spot. And as Worrell points out, well, when you look actually at some of the historical material, in particular at a report of a committee of the French Academy assessing the theory, that novel prediction gets very little attention, even though it seems to be one of the most astounding novel successful predictions that we find in the history of science, because it was also actually derived by somebody else, Poisson. It's also known as the Poisson white spot or bright spot, and, you know, and he derived in order to prove that the theory was actually somewhat absurd, because it had this consequence, and it was discovered, but that didn't seem to play such a big role in the assessment of the theory. Instead, the committee focused more on phenomena that were already known, namely straight edge diffraction patterns, where the theory had a very, you know, good story to tell. There are other examples: Mendeleev's successful prediction of new chemical elements, And for example, also Einstein's prediction of light bending that was confirmed by Eddington and others in 1919. So there's historical evidence, right, that scientists don't seem to care so much more about novel success. In fact, sometimes, some people have argued they actually care more about the explanation of already known phenomena. Like in Einstein's case, Brush, the historian Brush, points out that Einstein received much more credit for successfully explaining the advance of Mercury's perihelion that was known for decades, and that posed a major problem for Newtonian mechanics. That was a big anomaly, at least for the theory. And then he has this idea of use novel success, and he claims to make sense of these cases. The idea is that if we don't use evidence in the construction of theories, and we can derive these, derive the evidence from the theory nevertheless, then that should count as novel, regardless of whether the phenomenon was already known when the theory was designed. In the book, I point out that there's actually a strong and a weak version of this, and I think that the weak version doesn't really fly. Because it seems to make the confirmation of theory contingent on the action of scientists that might be totally obscure to the scientific community, right? If whether somebody used a piece of evidence or not in the construction of the theory, but actually he himself has this other version that often gets that he presents alongside with a weak version without really distinguishing them, and it's. That strong version is about basically parameter fixing. So, if you have three parameters in a theory, then if you fix a free parameter in order to accommodate a piece of evidence, then that's not really support for the theory. And then there are other versions of that, one by Hitchcock and Sober, who claim that you have this relationship between the number of free parameters in your theory and a theory's predictive success, which I think may hold, in the context of data models, but it's hard to really extrapolate that, to higher level theories, which we're actually interested in the realism debate. And so the rationale has to do with the fact that sometimes you have noise in the data, right? And if you have if you overfit your model to the data that contains noise, then obviously it won't be as predictive as a theory that has less parameter fixed to this particular data set. And there are other attempts to motivate our intuition that novel success is really impressive. and I discussed those. So there's one having to do with coin flipping, and different scientists making predictions about the outcome of those tosses. I'm not sure we need to go into details here, but I end up concluding that none of these rationales that have been offered are very compelling, and also discuss in some detail the Mendeleev case, again, the successful prediction of new chemical elements, and it seems that so an interesting thing that happened there was that actually he also predicted that some of the weights or some of the information known about the chemical elements at that time, or what people thought they knew, was actually incorrect. So, for example, he predicted that the weight of uranium should be around 240 instead of 120, and he was right about that. So I call that a contra-prediction. So that's something that's been also pointed out by Brush, the historian. I take that to be some evidence for what I call symptomatic predictivism. Namely, the idea that the predictions can have some epistemic weight when they reveal the actuality of a certain theoretical property, namely explanatory coherence, which you arguably had in the periodic table by Mendeleev. So, interestingly, before Mendeleev, there never was, you know, a coherent table of all the chemical elements that, you know, would outline their properties. Yeah, major reason where, you know, where these chemical elements that where people had wrong information about them, and Mendeleev, he elevated this criterion of weight you know to principle, and that's not the only principle he used. There's other important information about the properties of chemical elements that went into the table. But he used, you know, this criterion pretty much coherently, and then decided that the weights should be corrected, the weights and some of the properties of the chemical elements. So I have this, you know, I have this this yeah. So I don't think there's, you know, an intrinsic reason why novel success should count more. And in fact, yeah. So Mendeleev himself, he mentioned that what he particularly emphasized was that the table gives you very good reasons for believing that a certain element ought to have certain properties, and that's actually what's important. Whether the whether the evidence is novel or not is, I think, secondary.
Right. Okay. That's good. Well, there's a lot more to discuss, and I'm sort of we don't have that much time to go. So, toward the end of the book, you address what you call the negative view, which is just the idea that all these theoretical virtues aren't epistemic at all. Of course, they're merely pragmatic. You know, they help us manipulate things and coordinate our behavior or whatever. And you go through a number of different actual examples of scientists making choices that you argue show that this negative view is false, that they are making these choices there on the basis of these virtues, and that the role that the virtues are playing is in fact an epistemic one for these scientists in their actual choices. We're not going to have time to obviously to go through all of these different cases, but maybe you could just say, you know, quickly one of them, maybe Watson and Crick, or, you know, that's fairly widely known, and so maybe that might be a good one. You know, Watson, Crick, and the structure of DNA molecules.
Yeah, very good. So Crick and Watson, they didn't produce any evidence themselves about, you know, the structure of the DNA. So that was mostly provided by Franklin at the King's College in London. And Franklin, she produced several pieces of evidence, and one of these seemed to indicate actually an asymmetric structure, which was inconsistent with the helix, and she was actually pretty keen on that, and she tried to develop a model that would accommodate both that picture, but also, you know, a picture which very much seemed to support a helical structure, which Crick and Watson focused on, and they had good reasons to focus on that, because there's this theory of helical diffraction that that tells you, that, you know, what kind of pattern you ought to get if the underlying structure is a helix, namely this X-shaped pattern that you could observe in this very famous photo 51, I think it's called number 51. So you had a situation of conflicting evidence. So that's a common theme for all of these cases that I discussed. And then you have some scientists, abiding by the evidence, trying to make sense of all the evidence that they have. And then you have some scientists that, in these cases, interestingly, ended up, you know, making the groundbreaking discovery. So these are not So I'm important cases. They're actually, super central and very important cases for the development of science, and cases which we actually, often present as some of the greatest successes of science. And in this particular example, then Crick and Watson, on the basis of the theory that they had there, that gave them good reasons to believe in the helical structure, they neglected that apparently counter evidence. And we can make sense of that, I argue, by presuming that the theoretical virtues that some of these theories had, for example, in this case, the double helix provided a very nice replication mechanism. So you could argue that that the virtue of it had a virtue of fertility, or at least potential fertility. It was pretty simple, and so on. So if you presume that these virtues are epistemic, then you can make sense of the choices that were made by Crick and Watson, namely to believe in to ignore this apparently negative evidence, right? And again, they didn't have very good experimental reasons for saying, okay, this is bad evidence. They didn't produce any kind of evidence themselves. They had to rely on Franklin, but they were pretty dismissive about this kind of evidence for the reasons that I mentioned. So my argument then is, if these virtues are not epistemic, then it seemed to be just methodologically wrong for them to just throw out part of the evidence. It's not if the virtue is epistemic and they tell you something about the truth content of these theories. So it's a kind of dilemma that I draw up there in favor for the theoretical virtues being epistemic. And of course, again, and that's something that I stress throughout the book, and that's something that hasn't been, I think, discussed at all, is that the possibility theoretical virtues can be relatively truth conducive, right? They don't need to guarantee the truth of theories. They can still be epistemic. I think that's plausible in these cases.
Last question: what is on the horizon for you? Are you following up this book, or are you going in a different direction? What are you working on now?
I'm in the middle of going in a different direction. So I have a project that's been running a couple of years already, and that's on intuitions in science and philosophy, and that's. So there's a lot of experimental philosophy that we're doing, actually. So we're interested in the so-called expertise defense that some people have suggested in response to some of the experimental results that seem to show that our judgments and thought experiments, or what sometimes people call intuitions, but many other people prefer to call just case judgments, including Irom Mashri, for example. So that these judgments are unreliable because they're subject to order effects and so on. And we in the project, we focus on expertise defense and try to approach it empirically. So what is philosophical expertise? What would it mean for these judgments and these thought experiments? What kinds of skills would you need to have? And another sub-project focuses on linguistic intuitions, where also, just like in philosophy, linguistic intuitions are used as, more specifically, syntactic intuitions are used as evidence for building grammars. How is that possible? So that's the leading question of the project. And we also have one on thought experiments in physics, and we ask, are thought experiments in physics really so different from thought experiments in philosophy? If they're not, then it seems that there's some good grounds for the expertise to be run in both fields. Yeah, so that's what I'm working on currently, and also a bit on scientific explanation. So yeah, I have several projects running.
Very good. Well, I look forward to reading about seeing what the fruits of those various projects are.
Me too.
But I think we're out of time at the moment. So I just want to say thank you again for taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy.
Yeah, thank
I've
you
enjoyed
very
our
much.
Conversation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Samuel Schindler, Associate Professor of Philosophy of Science at Aarhus University in Denmark. We've been talking about his new book, Theoretical Virtues in Science, Uncovering Reality Through Theory, which is just out from Cambridge University Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.